Hello, Bill.
Hello, Con. You are watching the Week in Blog. Don't adjust your Wayback Machines. It is Bill, Sharon, Con, Carol back again.
I know. It's like it was 2008 again.
Do you want to put on your Hotline Blogometer cap instead of your Heritage cap and do it that way?
Oh, I don't think I ever really take either cap off.
We're in the post Matt Lewis era. We're still feeling our way, so it's good that you could fill in while we cast about for the next chapter in the Week in Blog. But for those who don't remember our glory days, why don't you introduce yourself again?
Oh, my name is Con Carroll. I am currently the official blogger here at the Heritage Foundation, but not too long ago I was the blogometer, now defunct blogometer. But, you know, still a great publication.
And I'm Bill Scher, Campaign for America's Future at ourfuture.org, also liberaloasis.com, and host of the Liberal Oasis radio show, available as podcast at said liberaloasis.com. But without further ado, I'd say the biggest blog topic of the week was the Tea Party uprising in Delaware, where conventional wisdom, blog wisdom on the left, is that the Tea Party have handed a Senate seat to the Democrats. Is there anything in the conservative blogosphere that said, oh man, why don't we screw that one up? Or is it all just Tea Party love?
Oh, well, I think it's much more fascinating to look first at what happened beforehand, because it got nasty. And it was definitely the nastiest Tea Party establishment fight that I've seen yet so far. If you look at Mike Lee in Utah or Miller in Alaska or even Chuck DeBoer in California, you had some disagreements, but it was still probably, get along, may the best man win or woman. Nothing got personal. Everything was kind of above board. But that was just completely out the door in Delaware this time around. You had really just some very personal attacks going on between Mark Levin and the Weekly Standard, John McCormick.
You might not believe this, but there are people on the left who don't know who Mark Levin is.
Oh. I thought everyone on the left knew who the main functionaries are in the conservative messaging machine. No, Mark Levin's a pretty established, well-known on the right, conservative radio talk show host. So he has his own platform out there in conservative talk show land.
He had a big statement on Facebook.
Right.
So he's an early blog.
Correct. But he's in the larger conservative messaging community. So you're right. He does not have his own. He's not a blogger, but he is a radio host and author.
But does he Facebook regularly? Is he Palin-esque in his Facebook commentaries?
He uses it in much the same way. Is he as prolific on Facebook as she is? No. But, he definitely uses it in the same way she does to weigh in on things when he wants to.
Because you had this point where after Miller won in Alaska, I believe Politico ran a story saying, well, does this mean that O'Donnell's got a shot in Delaware now? No one's polled this thing. Who knows? And not only did party establishment people start turning their fire on O'Donnell, but there were some prominent conservatives that said, this woman's out to lunch.
Yeah.
And that got Mark Levin's back up.
Right. You had Charles Krautheimer on Fox News called Jim DeMint. Jim DeMint, a pretty credible guy, called Jim DeMint's endorsement of Christine O'Donnell deplorable. Yeah, pretty much.
I didn't realize Charles Krauthammer was a party functionary. I thought he was a reasoned and detached political analyst.
He is a well respected opinion journalist by the conservative movement.
Still.
Yeah.
After calling Jim DeMint deplorable, we saw. I mean, forgive me if I'm
go right ahead.
Distracting me from your story. But there's various themes that come up in liberal blogging since the race, and part of it is watching the conservative feeding frenzy, and to see Karl Rove within 24 hours go from this woman's nutty to going on Fox, to go back on Fox and say, hey, I was the first one to endorse her after this, produce some mockery on the left. You had Steve Bannon at the Washington Monthly saying, remind us, Carl, did the endorsement come before or after you questioned her, quote, rectitude and truthfulness of sincerity and character, unquote? The Fox News screen only showed Roe from the chest up. If the camera panned down, he might have seen the tail between his legs. Is it strange in the conservative movement to see this extremely abrupt shift to getting on the O'Donnell bandwagon now?
No, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, kind of what her problems were, you know, it wasn't like, you know, she really ran on anything. It was just opposing Castle, and that was what was so hard for a lot of Christine O'Donnell's detractors, is that, you know, nobody wanted to be pro Castle. You know, nobody wanted to say, oh, you know, you support Castle. You know, but at the same time, I think the most troubling allegation against Christine O'Donnell was the fact that she once worked for a conservative, well-known, well-thought-of think tank, ISI. They publish books and do other educational activities. They've been around for years, and you know, upstanding, good member of the community. So Christine was hired to do some publicity for them back in the late 90s and even into today. Or not in today, but she was tired to do some publicity for them. And basically she didn't do a good job, and so they let her go. And then she sued them for like $4 million you know, sued them for gender discrimination, which is, you know, something
if you're... frivolous lawsuit.
Right. Well, you know, if you're conservative, you know, it's a classic frivolous, whiny, liberal lawsuit, you know, suing for gender discrimination. And then on top of that...
Because that never happened.
And then on top of that, she said in her filing that she was taking a master's course at Princeton, which was just not true. So there's the whole truthiness problem there, too.
I thought that... This came out on the Huffington Post, other places. She said, I'm politically incorrect, that if Hitler showed up to your doorstep and you were harboring a Jew, you would not lie in that circumstance, because lying was the most important thing you could possibly do.
Right. I think that kind of hit the airwaves after, and that has not made the rally on the conservative side of the blogosphere. But she has a strained relationship with the truth. I mean, that, you know, that's why you saw a lot of the kind of more... conservatives who have been around for a while, you know, really question the wisdom of making her the candidate. But since then, I think what you've seen, and it was depending on who you're talking to, like, as
I mean, is anyone sticking to their guns for those who are critical of her before the election day? Is anyone saying afterwards this is really bad for the conservative movement to have someone with a bizarre relationship to the truth as a standard bearer?
No, I mean, I think what you're seeing is, you know, pretty much right away you had, you know, Jonah Goldberg making a post, and then Tim Carney wrote this a couple days later, you know, that, you know, basically it's just the collateral damage of the Tea Party movement, is that, we're probably going to lose the seat now. Yeah, she's not the best candidate. Yeah, she doesn't put the best foot forward for the conservative movement. But when you look at the benefit, if you look at what the Tea Party has done for conservatives on net, they are definitely net plus. So, you know, if you look at any...
Now, is that identical? We talked about this on the show last week with the Christmas Solstice. Eric Erickson at Red State earlier said, I would rather have 50 seats without Castle than 51 with Castle. Is Jonah taking it to that degree, that it's better to not have control of the Senate, to not have conservative control of the agenda of the Senate, if you have to stomach having a single moderate in your caucus?
Right. No, I don't think Jonah's taking it that far. I mean, when he's talking about net benefit, he means not just electorally, but definitely electorally, is that, you know, if without the excitement of, you know, conservatives showing up to the polls in numbers that, if you look at the primaries turnout throughout the country, they're the you know, carbon opposite of what they were in 2008. You know, in 2008, you saw in state after state, Democrats are showing up to the polls in far, far greater numbers than Republicans were for primaries. And then, of course, in 2010, it's the opposite. And without Tea Parties, that just doesn't happen. And so, you know, the only reason you have, you know, a Scott Brown in the Senate today, or the only reason that we have a chance at all in, you know, West Virginia, Illinois, Washington, California, you know, all of the Nevada, you know, all of these, you know, purple to blue states, is because of the Tea Party movement. And so...
But you can't do it with the Tea Party alone. The Tea Party encompasses...
I don't think that's what I said.
I'm not saying you were saying that, but if you can't accept any moderates in your caucus, I mean, you have posted Paul Waldman at American Prospect, outside of a few marginal figures like Christine Todd Whitman, was there anyone in the Republican Party saying that Bush's failures should be met with a turn to the center? Like Michael Castle, the moderates are purged one by one until there's no one left in the party to make that case. Now, Democrats have a very difficult time managing their liberal and moderate wings, but you don't have anything like, and you have a case like Joe Lieberman, of course, where people did try to drive him out of the party, but it was in Connecticut where people thought that was a safe place to do that. No one's trying to do that in Nebraska or Indiana or Montana or Alaska.
No, there's no doubt that, you know, the strong feeling is that it's a tactical error, you know, that this is not something a tactically strategic, this is not a good strategic move, but that, you know, the Tea Party as a movement is kind of a blunt force, and, you know, blunt forces, even though they can get things accomplished, aren't always the most tactically wise political practitioners.
But your earlier point and Jonah's point is, well, you need that energy, so it's a net plus.
Right.
But since when did the conservative movement have a problem energizing their base? They've always been able to energize their base.
Not when you got a guy who's a compassionate conservative who says the role of government is to move whenever someone needs help. Not when you got George Bush and you know, his Medicare Part D.
Did George Bush have a problem getting elected president that I'm not aware of?
I'm sorry?
Did George Bush have a problem getting elected president that I was not aware of?
It was pretty close, both in 2000 and 2004, and he was definitely dead weight in 2006 and 2008.
I mean, but that was not because he was a bizarro, I think as you phrased it, a crypto-socialist. I think it was because it was the failures of his own conservative policies, but it's that inability to recognize that fact is arguably benevoling Republicans and conservatives today.
Yeah, I'm just gonna have to go ahead and disagree with you there. I think there's a large swath of, you know, kind of pro voters, independents, even movement conservatives who are disappointed with Bush's record on spending and the growth of government. I mean, you know, my God, he presided over the largest expansion of the welfare state since the Great Society with Medicare Part D. Instead of getting rid of a department, he created an entire new one with the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, I know people on the left and liberals and progressives don't think there's any reality or sincere belief in small government conservatism. But if you can grant at all that there are some true believers out there, you can see how they might be disillusioned by Bush, no?
I can grant that there are critiques to make.
Okay.
I don't think that's why he lost in 2006 and why Obama won in 2008. I don't think it's because the right was so mad at George Bush that they voted for Democrats out of anger or stayed home in mass.
I don't think it's the only reason. It's probably not even the biggest one, but it's definitely a big reason why conservative turnout was so depressed in 2008 and 2006.
So upshot is, have the hard feelings now been put aside now? I mean, now that Roe has made his mea culpa and the critics are piping down...
Some more than others. You know, you see, you know, Rush was taking a big victory dance all day yesterday. You know, Michelle Malkin and you know, Dan Rial wanted Cornyn to resign, and you know, they're celebrating when Cornyn backtracked and put money into the race. And on the other side, you know, David Ferdoso, even the day after, had you know, another post. Detailing all of Christine O'Donnell's sins, if you will. So I'm not going to say it's completely quieted down, but for the most part, I think the realization is, you know, she's not great, but she's ours. She's on the ticket, and so, you know, let's go win this thing.
One last thing to throw out at you, and so I can self-promote my own blog. Like, I had put forth just before Election Day that primarily global warming drove conservatives not only to dislodge Castle in Delaware and throw away.
Oh, because of his cap and trade vote?
Right. I mean, Castle is one of 8 House Republicans to actually vote for a cap and trade bill.
Okay. I'm with you so far.
And many people don't know this, but without those 8 Republican votes, that cap and trade bill would not have passed the House.
Right, right.
There's often a lot of dismissal on the left that why are you bothering to gain Republican votes? That was a case where you literally needed them or else it would not have passed. And the very top of Christine O'Donnell's website, when they, on her list of issues, the number one thing was was highlighting Castle's cap and trade vote. And just previously in Alaska, Murkowski, who wasn't even all that favorable to Democrats on cap and trade, she fought cap and trade all this year. She's been pushing legislation to prevent the EPA from regulating greenhouse gases. But she does actually acknowledge that there is such a thing as climate science. And she has supported cap and trade proposals previously. That was too much for the Alaska Tea Party. Joe Miller said this is Exhibit A, quote-unquote, why Murkowski has to go. And now Miller may actually win in Alaska. I don't say it's a sure loss, but it's taking what was a safe Republican seat in Alaska and making it competitive, seemingly because conservatives just can't accept the reality of climate science. You know, regardless of your issue of the what to do about it, it seems like the notion that global warming is not actually happening, regardless of what every scientist says, is making it, it has led conservatives to put 2 Senate seats at risk. And that just strikes me as bizarre.
Well, I think it's another bonus of the O'Donnell victory, if you're a DeMint guy, is, you know, yes, you know, it may make it, you know, one seat harder to take over the Senate. But what it does do is it makes what Republicans are in the Senate now and will be in the Senate in the next session that much more scared that, you know, if you do stray from the conservatives on an issue like, oh, I don't know, say the Bush tax cuts, that you will be O'Donnell in 2012.
But Murkowski didn't actually stray. you could say Castle strayed if you want to say voting for the Republican idea of cap and trade, that's somehow straying, fine. But Murkowski didn't actually stray. She was the chief obstructionist. It's weird that
she wasn't the chief obstructionist, but she was definitely in negotiations. You know, she wasn't on the Tom Coburn never or Jim Inhofe never side of the cap and trade ledger.
She had to actually go to the White House and have a conversation about it. That's a bridge too far.
Hey, you know, if the question is, would I rather have Tom Coburn or Lisa Murkowski? Or I guess the question is, would I rather have Joe Miller or Lisa Murkowski?
Jim Manzi guy.
I'd rather have. I don't think Jim Manzi would vote for any cap and trade bill
he does acknowledge that global warming is happening.
I guess I disagree with your premise that she was punished for her view on global warming happening. I think it was much more of her willingness to entertain the idea of a cap and trade system that got her in trouble.
Do you think anyone who's voted for Joe Miller or Christine O'Donnell thinks global warming is happening?
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are thousands.
I'll leave the topic on that note. Other big news, at least in the liberal blogosphere, maybe not so much in the conservative blogosphere, by the time this airs, I believe President Obama will have formally named Elizabeth Warren to be special assistant to the president, counselor to the Treasury Secretary, with the role of setting up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was established in the Wall Street Reform Bill. And when that bill passed, one of the things that was set up to be a litmus test whether the bill was sufficiently progressive or not was, would this be included? And it was included not quite as an independent agency, as part of the Fed, but with a certain degree of autonomy. And that made the praise from the left for the bill, one of the reasons why the praise for the bill in the end was muted. And then very quickly afterwards, the argument was put forth, if you want to prove, President Obama, that this you are really serious about cracking down on Wall Street, you have to appoint Elizabeth Warren, who can conceive the entire idea for this agency, to be the first chair of it. And if you don't do that, that will be a signal to us that you're not serious about Wall Street reform. And now they weren't willing, at least at this juncture, to formally nominate her, but there's a provision in the law that allows for an interim person to help set it up through the Treasury Department. That's what she is reportedly going to receive. And this on the left has sparked a round of commentary whether that is good enough or not. And you had...
Well, didn't Brent Podowski have a point at the Huffington Post that the way to get liberals and all of the people that showed up to the polls in 2008 for Barack Obama would be to nominate Elizabeth Warren?
Well, there were several posts like that. And so the question now is this particular, the way they've structured this nominee, does that meet that goal? Because she's not being formally nominated as the chair of the Bureau. She's not going to the Senate for a confirmation. Part of the argument was that it would be good to have the confirmation fight and force people to take a stand on it. But you have some commentary. Robert Kuttner at Huffington Post called it a huge win, and saying that he knows Elizabeth Warren. For those who are concerned that she's being co-opted, that there's no way you can co-opt Elizabeth Warren because she's as right as rain. Atrios said, the buzz I was hearing was that contrary to what some people thought, they didn't really have the authority to appoint a real interim director, but that it's a Treasury of the authority to run things in the interim. Distinction without a difference, perhaps, but it seems I hope to put her in charge in all but name. But you have other folks, my colleague at Campaign for America's Future, Zach Carter, conflicted about it, sort of taking a wait-and-see approach and saying, is Obama going to make Warren an advisor, reports not only to the Treasury, but directly to the president himself? We'll see how this works in practice. Obama's really trying to assure reform advocates that he's serious. If Obama actually plans to listen to Ward, he's not only putting the right person in the job at the right time, using the appointment to show he's very serious. But Warren could become another Volcker, someone who in the administration systematically ignores except when it needs to score political points with reformers. And that point was amplified by Jeff Smith over Naked Capitalism. Jeff Smith being more pessimistic that she would almost surely become a Paul Volcker who would be kept to the sidelines. So there's still a bit of debate within the left where this is sufficient enough, although I think most of the groups who have been following financial reform, like Americans for Financial Reform, have been very effusive about the pick.
Don't you think it's kind of silly that the liberals' view of this entire 2,000-page bill with all these issues comes down to the one person that is or is not going to be there for maybe or maybe not the first 5 years that this agency is going to exist?
I think it's a fair argument that liberals often, hang their hats on one thing or one person as a proxy or a signal whether things are sufficiently good enough or not. In this case, there's been a longstanding gulf between the left, between much of the left, I wouldn't say all of the left, but much of the left and the White House on financial reform. Still a lot of hard feelings about the entire TARP process. A lot of folks that thought that a lot of these institutions should have been left to fail and not be bailed out by our government. And in the process of the Wall Street Reform Bill, a lot of folks have wanted to see the size of banks be capped. And that was the one provision that lost pretty handily when it was put on the floor in the Senate. And so there was people complaining about that this meant that all that just trying to tighten up the regulations wouldn't be good enough. You had to really cap the size of the banks themselves to be sure they couldn't get too big to fail. Now, there's other folks on the left, like Paul Krugman, who disagree with that, said that tightening up regulations would be good enough. So it's not a uniform point. But for those who feel that way, it quickly shifted to putting it all on Warren's shoulders. This is the final test if you're serious or not. And it's really a fair critique to say that it's overly simplistic to put it all on her shoulders, but that is where I think a lot of the left is right now.
Well, first let me say that nobody cares about this issue on the right, and I would say in 99.9% of the country.
I'll tell you this, though. If she wasn't picked, I think the point that you make that the right isn't focusing on this, I think, is extremely important. I think this is a parallel situation, or should I say a flip side, to the Employee Free Choice Act at the start of the Obama administration, where you had the entire corporate community unified against stopping it, allowing easing the ability for unions to organize. And before the left even could, you know, barely have a meeting on the subject, there was just a blast of attacks on the concept, and it pretty much killed it in its crib.
Thank you. I don't know about that. I'm sitting here in my office in Heritage. I've got a nice, actually it's a smaller office, but a nice new view, and I can see AFL-CIO headquarters across the way. And I don't remember them laying down at the beginning. I remember the AFL-CIO coming out with guns blazing too. So,
I mean, it was a number one priority of the AFL-CIO and every other union out there. But they were not nearly prepared for the assault that came, you know, before Obama even was inaugurated. I think people thought they had a little bit of time to really roll out their stuff. But that was just a blind side. And, you know,
this issue existed, I mean, this Congress wasn't the first one to debate this issue. I mean, bills were introduced by the same name in the previous Congress.
Sure.
I mean, I just find it hard to believe that they were caught that flat-footed. I mean, they've been introducing this legislation for a while now.
I mean, maybe it's an exaggeration to say they're totally flat-footed, but I do think they were not prepared for a full-on battle right away. And perhaps thought they didn't need to have a full-on battle because they had enough people in the Senate that it shouldn't require that much firepower. But as a general rule, I think when corporate America is unified, you're dead. And the White House has won battles when it's been able to split the corporate community in some fashion, which they did not do in the Employee Free Choice Act. In the case of Elizabeth Warren, you know, the left, the organized left, was organized right away. You know, it's Warren or nothing, buddy. And the extent that the banks didn't want her there, they either weren't prepared to do anything about it. As you note, the right doesn't seem to be very focused on this. And I think there has also been reporting that banks were aware that if they did come out openly against her, that would totally backfire because everybody hates the banks. And they would just prove the left's point. So they weren't really able to do any kind of serious organizing against her. And that created a dynamic where even if there was skepticism within the White House about her, which we've heard some reporting that there was, we don't really know. If they were reluctant to do it, they were really boxed in, because if they didn't do it, and even if you're right that no one's going to care after the fact, if they didn't do it, the hammering they would have gotten from the left that would have been echoed by a lot of, you know, traditional media pundits who were sympathetic to Warren and sympathetic to the notion that Obama is being a timid reformer. I think that would have really resonated and caused a major problem going into the election.
Well, can I step back for a second and just ask this? You know, does it bother you at all that the fate of such an important issue like financial regulation is so dependent on getting the exact right expert into the exact right job, as opposed to having a system where it's more focused on a rule of law, that everyone knows the rules going in, and it's not dependent on the discretion of the experts getting it right all the time?
Well, this was a critique on the part of the left that wanted to have that cap on bank size, who said you can't, while you want good regulation, you want good regulators, you can't put all your chips in that basket because Wall Street's always going to be one step ahead, and therefore you want to make sure that the rules are really tight and clear. That's a fair argument, that doesn't necessarily mean you want to be totally, even if that's true, you don't want to have lax regulation or lax regulators. You still want the best. And while I agree with you that it's generally not wise to put all your chips on one person, I do think Elizabeth Warren does have a lot of unique qualifications in this area, and a lot of trust in a lot of corners of the country, even if not every last American. You know, she's not quite a household name, but there's a lot of folks who do have a lot of trust in her and knows full well that she's certainly not going to be co-opted by Wall Street. So there was a strong argument to make that she was a uniquely qualified person for the position.
Well, sticking on regulations and Wall Street, you had some posts on Basel III you wanted to highlight for everyone.
Well, this is, one of the reasons why there's a lot of focus on Warren is that it's a person sort of easier to rally around than the intricacies of banking regulations. And I am not a competent person to talk about banking regulations, but I do want to note that you did have this international body called Basel, And one of the things that was not addressed in the Wall Street bill was this issue of capital requirements. How much capital do banks have to have on hand for them to have as a cushion in case of a financial crisis? And banks don't want those requirements to be very high. They'd rather have money to throw around, not to sit somewhere. And there's an argument that it should not be done solely in the American Wall Street Reform Bill. This requires an international regime, and there is this group, Basel, that's done these things in the past. And so they released their new round of capital requirements this past week, and the financial reform blogging community, at least those that lean left, were very split on whether the rules were strong enough or not. You had some folks who were very respected in progressive quarters, like Mike Konzol at Rudy Baum, Felix Salmon at Reuters, and Ezra Klein, saying, you know, this is great. Finally, they're toughening up here and creating, you know, high enough thresholds that...
Stop the presses. Ezra Klein liked what a committee of experts did? Oh, my God.
It is a good one, but... I know it does not mean that conservatives should be so dismissive about actually having experts craft regulations. I know it's something that Heritage has never been a fan of.
Well, let me go ahead and skip to something that Zach Carter from some outfit called the Campaign for America's Future wrote.
My colleague Zach was not as thrilled with that, as well as a few others.
I really liked his post.
Well, read on. I'm sure Zach would appreciate it.
Okay. Let me see here. In every financial crisis in the history of banks... have ruined themselves by over-leveraging. Leveraging means borrowing money, and over-leveraging means borrowing too much money. Blah, blah, blah. There are dozens of different ways to define leverage, but the most difficult one for banks to manipulate is the simplest and most common sense. Total assets of total equity. Blah, blah, blah. For years, regulators have used very lax definitions of what constitutes capital in calculating their capital ratios. They've allowed banks to use lax definitions of what constitutes an asset and allowed the minimum ratios to be far too low. Basel III improved on the old regime by strengthening the definition of capital and raising the bar for the ratios themselves. It does not do much about the definition of an asset, however, which leaves the new standards open to abuse. Which I think is dead on.
So you agree with Zach that the regulations should be tighter?
No, not quite. First of all, I like the acknowledgement that the problem of this last financial crisis had to do with a problem of regulation. Noah Melman over at the American Thinker and the Ocean Blog, The Economist, wrote this. Developments in banking regulation in the last decades, meanwhile, have turbocharged this process, and I'm increasingly convinced contributed mightily to the financial crisis. At the heart of the financial crisis, after all, was banks investing in highly rated debt backed by lousy mortgages. But why do they hold so much of this debt? In part because they could plausibly argue that it was risk-free or nearly risk-free. AA and AAA rated debt had very low risk weighting. So what you saw is the reason why, you know, when this economy started melting down and the crisis happened, I'm sure you've seen that famous slideshow that shows, the bank in Sweden getting screwed over by the people on Wall Street because all of a sudden all their mortgage equities were related. But why was that bank in Sweden buying that stuff? Why is AIG buying so much of this stuff? You know, why is all these banks in Germany buying so much of this stuff? And the reason is regulation. It wasn't because of free market. It was because of Basel II with their regulations saying that AAA securities were an asset that qualified, created a huge demand for these all of these mortgage-backed securities. Without the Basel II regulations giving the stamp of approval to this type of asset, you wouldn't have had all this creation because there would be no demand for it.
It doesn't logically follow. That means you want even less regulation and less rules of the road.
No, so you keep using the more rules, less rules, and I'm arguing for just different rules that don't include...
Well, at least you agree there should be some rules.
Well, yeah, no, we definitely need rules. We definitely need rules. I just think having experts, or in this case, handing off to rating agencies to define what is a asset is the right way to go.
Zach Carter was one of those who was very critical about it. Simon Johnson basically said that what really was necessary was an entire rethink of this whole regime, and because there was some degree of pressure to get this done quickly, they couldn't take it as far as he would have liked. There was a Politico story saying that banks were actually quietly happy about this because they thought the rules were going to be much tougher. That led Kevin Drum to at Mother Jones say he had to give him second thoughts about the whole about his initial support of it, saying that basically does add a simple leverage ratio to complement the new capital requirements. Capital has to be at least 3% of total assets with no risk weighting. That's a good addition, but 3% produces leverage of 33-1. That's a lot of leverage, and as Zach Carter points out, probably too high to have any really moderating effect. So what's the right leverage number to shoot for? Martin Wolf at the Financial Times thinks it should be in the neighborhood of 5-1. That's probably too extreme in the other direction, but 10-15-1, that would do the job nicely. Bottom line, requiring banks to carry more and better quality capital is a good idea. Basel theory really does make things better, but I'm beginning to think that, like the Dodd-Frank financial reform bit, it only makes things a little bit better, consider me a bit deflated. There's this continuing conversation about how strong this is going to be. Now, the conversation may be a little bit meaningless as far as its impact on Basel III, but to the degree that the reform is an ongoing process, concerns about all of these things, whether it's the Wall Street Reform Bill, this is one of the concerns that Paul Krugman had pointed out before was if you don't do this right, you're not going to know you did it wrong until the next crisis hits, and that's not ideal. But hopefully this type of conversations can make sure that the reform process continues and things can get tidied up as we go along, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's a likelihood.
Cool. You want to talk about blogger outreach yet next?
Well, I guess as a somewhat related story, you had an interesting exchange this week with the White House's new chief of the Council of Economic Advisors, Austin Goolsbee, taking over for Christina Romer. Goolsbee has been on the Obama team, you know, since the beginning. He was already on the council. This is a promotion.
He was with the campaign early on. He's been with Obama forever.
Exactly. So there was some commentary on a few financial blogs. Forgive me for remembering Slackwire.
Duncan. I mean, Goolsbee responded personally to Duncan, though.
He responded to Duncan, but this blog, Slackwire, was the first to put out that Goolsbee had written a paper that was critical of
R&D
certain business tax incentives, right. R&D being one of them, that business tax incentives don't work as advertised. They don't actually prompt businesses to invest more in their operations and help grow the economy. And that blog Slackwire had made a crack saying Goolsbee is the perfect White House hire. His advice is already being ignored before he got the job.
Yeah, it's a good line. Good line.
Rorty Baum, Mike Konzel, picked that up, and I believe Atrius picked it up from that and made a similar point. And Goolsbee emailed Atrius, Duncan Black, directly to say such that circumstances are a little more are different in the current.
Well, bottom line, it's different during a recession.
Right, right. That would be the short story. And Atrius on his blog responded and said, okay, maybe it's not as terrible as that original paper might have suggested, but it's still not.
It's still not going big.
Right, it's not the biggest bang for the buck, which was my or Atrius's original point. But I was struck by the fact that the chief of the Council of Economic Advisors is emailing an individual blogger.
Not even a blogger conference call. Just an individual email.
And, people might not know this, but the Treasury Department has had regular, not just blogger conference calls, but blogger meetings. You know, we're actually bringing bloggers into the Treasury Department.
FaceTime with Geithner.
Right. FaceTime with Geithner, or sometimes they're off the record or deep background. They're not supposed to say it's with Geithner, but sometimes that's leaked anyway. This happened a few weeks ago. One of my colleagues, Richard Eskow, was there and wrote about it and talked about what was said in regard to Social Security and was very critical about what was said about Social Security. And in a previous meeting, these were both in August, if I recall, a group of bloggers were very critical about what was said about HAMP, the administration's anti-foreclosure program, arguing that they were admitting that it wasn't going to actually save, keep people in their homes, but only delaying the foreclosures and not produce as big a shock to the economy while we're in the middle of the recession.
Right. Well, I think the line that really got passed around was with Steve Randy Waldman, but I'm not terribly familiar with. But
it's Interfluidity's blog.
Right. Which confession I don't regularly read, but I do read Duncan. I love Duncan. So, anyways, Duncan linked to this guy and quoted his paragraph where he was saying, you know, people were pressing on you know HAMP and what was the major source of it. And or the major rationale behind it. And so what the Treasury people basically said, again, this is off the record, deep background, whatever, so there's no quotes here. But the impression that was left with the people in the room was that from the beginning, the mortgage modification process, the HAMP program, which is kind of redundant, HAMP has a program in it. But anyways, the point of the HAMP program from the beginning was never to help consumers. It was never a consumer help program. It was always from the beginning a bank stabilization program. And so when this was, again, there's no quote, so we can't tell how openly this was acknowledged. But for the people in the room, it was kind of like a oh my God moment. Like, oh my God, they admitted it. This was always about helping the banks. It was never about helping consumers. And so I think Steve's line was, oh, they're really cruel people. And H was like, yes, they're right. The people at Treasury are really cruel people. And it just got passed around the blog sphere. And for me, I was like, oh my God, that's quite a backfire of blogger outreach, because I think HS's line a couple of days later was just, you know, when liberalism fails, it discredits liberalism. And so, you know, and you know, Fire Dog Lake's been running a great series on the HAMP program and how it has not helped anybody. And you know, when you have all the promises that were made, and you have people in the progressive movement that really thought they were going to have a chance to solve this crisis their way, I thought it was as really deflationary for the left side of the blogosphere.
Well, in many respects, it is. Now, I do think that there's been you get differing interpretations of these meetings from different bloggers sometimes. But
and as an added bonus, there's no transcript.
Right. And maybe that's an argument for not doing these things on deep background, and there should be transcripts so people can. Not be relying on interpretation.
Well, then they wouldn't happen at all.
That would also be true. But clearly what what the White House and the Treasury Department's trying to do by having them on deep background is to really kind of walk through a lot of the details of this in a way that they're hoping is going to lead to more informed blogging.
Yeah, well, no, it shows that the White House sincerely believes in their strategy and believe that if they can just get their truth out there, that they will prevail. I mean, it does show a sincerity on their part in the rightness of their belief.
Right, but as you can see, it does not automatically lead to a lot of lovey-dovey, you know, back-padding type of posts. In many ways, it leads to a round of even more critical posts. And I remember full well when I was invited to meet with President Clinton with a group of bloggers, and the original one of the critiques was we're all getting co-opted now, and you know there wasn't necessarily a lot of lovey-dovey posts that came out of that one. Nothing as strongly strident as what you just cited, but none of these meetings have ever, I think, led to people changing their public statements or becoming on the team when they weren't on before. And despite, so you could argue that this you say it's a fail, it's a backfire. But the fact that Goolsbee is still continuing that approach and continue to engage bloggers who focus on these issues, these are issues that aren't even, you know, above-the-fold issues, front-page issues. They're getting really down in the wonky weeds a lot of the time. But they are trying to reach out to people who have audiences, who are trying to write about important issues and have that regular engagement. And the fact that they keep doing it, even when it doesn't work, you know, fantastically for them, I think is at least interesting.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things where it's just important. It's so important now to play the influencing game as much as possible, which includes, you know, forming relationships with opinion makers, and Duncan's a big one, as are, you know, all the bloggers that get invited to those meetings. And it's, you know, it's savvy. It's something you have to do. It's not, they don't have a choice in the matter. If they're going to be able to communicate effectively, it's something you have to do.
I mean, I don't know if you could make an argument that you don't have to. There are other ways you can communicate. I mean, these are often bloggers who are clearly not on board, who are very prone to writing critical things. You don't have to talk to them. You can try talking to more favorable folks if you want to. If you think these people are out to get me, I'm not going to talk to them at all. I'll just talk to regular reporters.
Yeah, but I think if you look, I don't think anyone on there is someone that the White House would consider is per se out to get them. You know, I think.
Have you read the Huffington Post?
I have.
Do they write anything about Wall Street or the foreclosure program that is not deeply critical of what the White House is doing?
But I've also read some things on Huffington Post that were positive about the Obama administration once or twice. There is some goodwill there.
Not. And the reporters, they're bringing Shaheen, I can't pronounce his last name properly, I think Naz report. I mean, he is relentless against the administration on these issues, and yet he was invited to one of these meetings.
I'm sure we could find some positive things he's written about the Obama administration on the economic front.
I'm hearing something, but the totality of his reporting is not favorable to the administration.
Fair enough. Well, I think, you know, the same could be said of Meghan McArdle and Tyler Cowen, that the, you know, probably preponderance, 51% of their reporting on Obama's economic performance or economic team would be bad so far, but I
say 51%.
Well, I'm just saying there it's net negative. But on the other,
were they invited to some of these meetings?
Oh yeah, yeah. And
so just to emphasize the point, those are not even anybody which, you know, coming from the left. These are conservative libertarian economic writers.
Right. But on the other hand, they are definitely have said things positive about them too. And so my point is that, you know, they're inviting people that have shown a history of being able to say positive things, and therefore, you know, want to increase that percentage.
Well, it's probably an attempt, I think, in a small way. It's certainly not by itself going to amount to too much. I think the White House would like to, and I think Obama said this fairly openly at times, you know, create some reasonable parameters for debate. So it's not just dominated by the Glenn Becks and the Sarah Palins. And you are talking about substantive issues and having disagreements, but having disagreements with, you know, some shared sense of the facts of the situation. And if you can find a group of bloggers that at least represents a diversity of views, but are not, you know, folks who do hatchet jobs, in theory you could achieve that. Although I'd argue that certainly this, you know, micro strategy is not overwhelming the Beckification of the discourse.
So, speaking of Glenn Beck...
I did that for you.
Thank you.
Though we should probably keep us a little bit short, though.
Yes. Speaking of Glenn Beck, I'm a big fan of Ronald Pastrito, who is a professor of politics at Hillsdale College, and he's written a number of products for Heritage on the progressive movement. So this would... predate Beck's move to Fox and predate the Obama campaign. So this would be stuff that we've been working with him on the progressive movement for, you know, a couple years. And Glenn Beck has since then, as I'm sure you know, and I know everyone at Media Matters know, Glenn Beck has gone on to have a sustained campaign as defining progressivism as the disease that afflicts America. I think he's even called it a cancer, maybe the cancer on America. And so I was interested to see a note in the Wall Street Journal, not a note, an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by Pastrito, you know, laying out a marker as to his, you know, where he agrees with Beck and where he doesn't. He wrote, "Whatever I or anyone else think of Mr. Beck's programming or political views, on one central historical issue he is correct. the progressive movement did indeed repudiate the principles of individual liberty and limited government that were the basis of the American Republic. Americans' original progressives were convinced that the country...
Did you say that was indisputable?
Indisputable.
Okay, I'm just making sure. There's no way you could dispute that.
Right, that's right. Just, America's original progressives...
Our nation's fifth grade socialist textbook.
America's original progressives were convinced that the country faced a set of social economic problems demanding a sharp increase in federal power. They also said that there was too much emphasis placed on protecting liberty of individuals at the expense of broader social justice. So, did this make them socialist? A charge frequently leveled by Mr. Beck. And here Pistrito kind of doubles down. Woodrow Wilson did oppose the actual social movement of his day, and he didn't believe that the government at the time was capable of accomplishing everything socialists then had in mind. Nevertheless, in his 1887 essay, Socialism and Democracy, Wilson considered the socialist principle that all ideal limitation of public authority by individual rights be put out of view to be entirely consistent with democratic principles. Quote, in fundamental theory, socialism and democracy are almost, if not quite, one and the same. They both rest at the bottom upon the absolute right of the community to determine its own destiny and that of its members. Limits of wisdom and convenience to the public control there may be, limits of principle and there are, upon strict analysis, none. And Pistrito then at the end close of his article then quotes Pete Stark, who is a modern-day representative out in the Hayward area, who said at a town hall recently that the federal government can do pretty much anything it wants in this country. So I do think it's an ongoing effort by the conservative movement to define the progressive movement as kind of outside the political tradition. You know, Paul Ryan has been banging this drum for a while, and he even got into a kind of a little spat with Glenn Beck a while back, which I actually haven't seen reported much, and it actually went on his show, and Glenn Beck and Paul Ryan then hugged and made up, and all agreed that progressives were bad. But again, I think it's an ongoing campaign that I find interesting, and as well as I do Glenn Beck's relationship with academics like Mr. Pistrito.
I found it a little strange that he wrote this op-ed now, but you know, Glenn Beck's argument that progressivism is a cancer, and I am one of its cancer cells, apparently, was not present at his most recent rally. There was an argument, it was put out by Politico, that he initially was going to have this big political rally. It was going to unveil this 100-year plan to restore America, and it's going to turn his entire following into a real bona fide political movement. And he did a total 180 on that and turned his rally into a religious revival. And there wasn't talk about progressivism being a cancer at the rally. Now, I don't listen to his show as often as you do, perhaps, Con, so maybe he's picked up that talking point again. What prompted the author, what's the professor's name?
Pistrito. Pistrito.
To revisit the point now, I don't totally get... It doesn't seem like that's really what's going to be a lot relevant in, you know, the midterm elections, for example. If folks think that equating progressivism with socialism is going to be the ticket to winning in November, I think that is way off. I just wrote a post myself looking at the most recent New York Times CBS poll where they asked the question, do you think Obama's grown the government too much? Not enough or about right, and only 37% said too much. And how many people thought that the stimulus was too big? Only 34% said it was too big. So those numbers track the long-standing ideological makeup of the country, where people who say they're conservatives are a little more than a third, people who say they're liberals are about a fifth, and people who say they're moderates are about two-fifths. And that's been the case for decades. It hasn't changed in the past 2 years. And impressions about Obama's record pretty much track along those ideological lines. So if you think that there's some opportunity to extinguish progressivism by equating it with socialism, and the country's ready for that argument, I see no evidence that that is the case.
Yeah, I don't have the Pew data in front of me, but I'm pretty sure the Pew data that they do every year, that the past years has shown that governments, Americans, are more skeptical of both government spending and the size and role of government. We can link it.
Skeptical of spending is a little different, and And there are certainly ways there. You could cherry pick lots of data, and granted, I just cherry picked a couple points. So if you want to call me a hypocrite, feel free. But
I don't think we have to say that.
But I think you have to look at all of those types of numbers together to really get a proper sense of what's going on. I mean, that same New York Times poll said 48% of plurality wants smaller government and less services than bigger government and more services. I could cherry pick that poll and say liberalism is out the door. Now, actually, that number was actually a smaller number for the conservative point than it was a few months ago. But that aside, it's still plurality. But the wording of that question might well be a little bit loaded, and people might think of smaller government in a different way than UConn Carroll might.
But wouldn't you at least see the value of what Glenn is doing for the conservative movement as trying to define progressivism? I mean, there's a reason why progressives were so upset by liberal fascism. You know, there's a method behind Beck's madness in trying to equate progressivism with socialism.
Yeah, it's not a hard one to analyze. I mean, it's pretty point A to point B what he's trying to do.
So you just think he's being ineffective?
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous. I think Glenn Beck is ridiculous.
Whether or not it's ridiculous or whether or not it's effective are two different questions.
I think it's ridiculous and ineffective.
Okay.
I don't see a lot of, and to extend the point, I don't see a lot of people calling liberals fascists, except in the Tea Party, which has the support of about 20% of the country. So, yeah, I think it's all ridiculous and silly and a waste of time.
Well, which is not what, you know, Jonah wanted to say, because, you know, he didn't think they were
fascists. Always the title of the book.
Right. But he wasn't calling them fascists. We'll let Jonah defend the book itself.
I wasn't calling liberals fascists. I just put the two words next to each other on the cover of my book.
I think he was trying to call them socialists.
And he has a bad speller for the people who wrote the cover of his book.
Fair enough. Well, I think it's a good place to end, unless you got anything else you want to say, Bill.
I think that's
good. Okay.
Always good to talk to you, Con.
Always good to talk to you.
So we'll be back next week for This Week in Blog. Take care.